Hello, family, friends, fans, casual acquaintances, and passing strangers. Welcome to Spider on the Web number 88. Here to ease us in this time is my sister Dory, slide guitarist Chris Richards, and Butch McCarthy, with a song whose lyrics were supplied by my darling Jeannie. Here's Heart Wounds. Not long before she had to leave, my Jeannie had a vivid dream in which she heard her youngest sister Dory singing a heartbreakingly sad song called Heart Wounds. On awakening, she grabbed pen and paper and wrote down all the lyrics she could remember. Dory and slide guitarist Chris Richards put them to music, and you just heard it, the first and last song Jeannie ever wrote. Welcome, friends, to the 88th installment of Spider on the Web. This time round, I have some brand new, just-released music by two people I deeply love, available in an array of up-to-the-minute audio formats, and I have some classic science fiction by someone else I deeply love in the form of a recording so far from brand new that it only exists on vinyl. The track I opened with, Heart Wounds, is from the new CD by Butch McCarthy and Dory Leger, Tickets to the Moon, whose title track I used to open my last podcast, Spider on the Web, number 87. Dory Leger is, like all four of them, my favorite sister-in-law, and in one of her many incarnations, she does booking for the Zyterian, the oldest and hippest theater in New Bedford, Massachusetts, with acoustics to die for. It is a totally happening place. By the time this is posted, you'll have just missed the great Cajun band Beau Soleil on its 35th anniversary tour, but you might still have time to catch ethereal jazz trumpeter Chris Botti, or the amazing Ballet Grand Prix, featuring the great José Manuel Careno in one of his last solo performances before he'll retire at the end of this year. And later on in the year, the Z will play host to acts as diverse as Kris Kristofferson, Yes, and the great Gordon Lightfoot. For a complete list, visit sextuplezyterion.org. That's Zeiterion.org. In another of her avatars, with her husband, guitarist Don Leger, Dory has performed both as a jazz singer and as a blues singer with the New Bedford band Blues Train. Longtime listeners to this podcast will remember some of those tracks, one of them, Bound to Your Heart, Jeannie asked to have played at her memorial service. But Dory's latest artistic incarnation is as half of the duo McCarthy and Leger, which I understand is just in the process of morphing into the acoustic trio McCarthy, Richards, and Leger, with the addition of slide guitarist Chris Richards, whom you just heard on Heart Wounds. She and Butch have been gigging in the New Bedford area for some time now, lately with Chris as a recent regular, and Tickets to the Moon is their second CD, a follow-up to a splendid plate called Damaged Goods. You can learn more about both them and the new trio either on Facebook or at McCarthyandLeger.com. That's McCarthyandLeger.com. Now, if you caught my last podcast, Spider on the Web, number 87, you heard a mess of magical music by my water brother and webmaster, Colin McDonald, performing live on his alto saxophone in my living room here at Tottering on the Brink, and duetting with his wife Andrea on recorders. And isn't that interesting? The spell checker built into Apple's text edit application just rejected the word duetting and changed it to what it was sure I meant to say, dueling. That tells you something about this culture. Well, here's some of The Cure. I'm delighted to report that Colin finally has a new CD out for your enjoyment, and I just love the title, Circle of Wind. As he explains in his liner notes, in 2005, I was lay ordained as a Zen practitioner by Tenshin Reb Anderson, who gave me the Dharma name Fuen Egaku, or Circle of Wind, Eternal Music. I knew this was a particularly apt title for my interior musical life, for as a performer on a wind instrument, I was fascinated by the technique of circular breathing, playing continuously while breathing in through the nose, as well as being drawn to cyclic music. This recording is thus a collection of my chamber music for saxophone, circles and cycles of wind that arose as expressions of the eternal sounds within. Colin McDonald. The notes conclude, by the way, this album is dedicated to the memory of Jeannie Robinson, dancer, choreographer, mentor, Zen buddy, and dear friend. Jeannie was also ordained by Tenshin Reb Anderson Zenki, and the Dharma name he gave her was Buchi Ehe, which means dancing wisdom, eternal peace. As you can see, Reb has a gift for naming. First, I'm going to play you the shortest track on the new CD, a very sweet piece Colin wrote to celebrate the anniversary of his friends Zeke and Nikki. It's a duet between his soprano sax and the cello of Stefan Hintersteininger. I think it will make a wonderful setup to the story that will follow it, which I believe to be one of the most horrifying love stories ever written. And so, here again is Colin McDonald with Here Again. Thank you. that's lovely. Now to chill your blood. The immortal Theodore Sturgeon completed the story that follows in May of 1939, and he once told me he brought it to the editor who bought most of his stuff at that time and sat and watched him read it. He said that editor finally stood up, flung the manuscript at Ted's head, and said, white-faced and trembling, "Get out of my office and never come back, you pervert." The story went on to be bounced with varying degrees of revulsion by every major American SF market. So Ted sent it to the British magazine Argosy and entered it in a contest with a $1,000 prize. It won, beating out an entry by Graham Greene, and has been anthologized countless times since. In 1976, Ted recorded the story for Alternate Worlds Records, which as far as I know is now defunct, and there has never been a cassette or CD release to my knowledge. I've wanted to play it for you for a long time, with permission from Ted's daughter, Noelle, but up until now I was stymied by lack of a turntable. Fortunately, Terry and her own, my daughter and son-in-law, gifted me with a USB turntable this Christmas, and so here now is the immortal Theodore Sturgeon with one of the most disturbing love stories of all time, Bianca's Hands.
Bianca's Hands was written when I was still in or just barely out of my teens. It intruded itself between me and the work that I was trying to do to get money to eat. It was so insistent that it had to be written anyway, and after it was written, I couldn't sell it and I couldn't give it away. For 10 whole years, people found it too disturbing. Ultimately, it won a literary contest in England and the first check I had ever seen for over $1,000. Bianca's Hands. Bianca's mother was leading her when Rand saw her first. Bianca was squat and small with dank hair and rotten teeth. Her mouth was crooked and it drooled. Either she was blind or she just didn't care about bumping into things. It didn't really matter because Bianca was an imbecile. Her hands. They were lovely hands, graceful hands, hands as soft and smooth and white as snowflakes, hands whose color was lightly tinged with pink like the glow of Mars on snow. They lay on the counter side by side, looking at Rand. They lay there half-closed and crouching, each pulsing with a movement like the panting of a field creature. And they looked, not watched. Later they watched him, and now they looked. They did, because Rand felt their united gaze, and his heart beat strongly. Bianca's mother demanded cheese stridently. Rand brought it to her in his own time while she berated him. She was a bitter woman, as any woman has a right to be who is wife of no man and mother to a monster. Rand gave her the cheese and took her money and never noticed that it was not enough because of Bianca's hands. When Bianca's mother tried to take one of the hands, it scuttled away from the unwanted touch. It didn't lift from the counter but ran on its fingertips to the edge and leapt into a fold of Bianca's dress. The mother took the unresisting elbow and led Bianca out. Rand stayed there at the counter unmoving, thinking of Bianca's hands. Rand was strong and bronze and not very clever. He had never been taught about beauty and strangeness, but he didn't need that teaching. His shoulders were wide and his arms were heavy and thick, but he had great soft eyes and thick lashes. They curtained his eyes now. He was seeing Bianca's hands again, dreamily. He found it hard to breathe. Harding came back. Harding owned the store. He was a large man whose features barely kept his cheeks apart. He said, "Sweep up, Rand. We're closing early today." Then he went behind the counter, squeezing past Rand. Rand got the broom and swept slowly. "A woman bought cheese," he said suddenly. "A poor woman with very old clothes. She was leading a girl. I can't remember what the girl looked like except..." "Who was she?" "I saw them go out," said Harding. "The woman is Bianca's mother, and the girl is Bianca. I don't know their other name. They don't talk to people much. I wish they wouldn't come in here. Hurry up, Rand." Rand did what was necessary and put away his broom. Before he left, he asked, "Where do they live, Bianca and her mother?" "On the other side, a house on no road away from people." "Good night, Rand." Rand went from the shop directly over to the other side, not waiting for his supper. He found the house easily, for it was indeed away from the road and stood rudely by itself. The townspeople had cauterized the house by wrapping it in empty fields. Harshly, "What do you want?" Bianca's mother said as she opened the door. "May I come in?" "What do you want?" "May I come in?" he asked again. She made as if to slam the door and then stood aside. Come. Ren went in and stood still. Bianca's mother crossed the room and sat under an old lamp in the shadow. Ren sat opposite her on a three-legged stool. Bianca was not in the room. The woman tried to speak, but embarrassment clutched at her voice. She withdrew into her bitterness, saying nothing. She kept peeping at Ren, who sat quietly with his arms folded and the uncertain light in his eyes. He knew she'd speak soon, and he could wait. Well, she was silent after that for a time, but now she had forgiven him his intrusion. Then, it's a great while since anyone came to see me. A great while. It was different before. I was a pretty girl. She bit her words off and her face popped out of the shadows, shriveled and sagging as she leaned forward. Ren saw that she was beaten and cowed and did not want to be laughed at. Yes, he said gently. She sighed and leaned back so that her face disappeared again. She said nothing for a moment, sitting looking at Ren, liking him. We were happy, the two of us, she mused, till Bianca came. He didn't like her, poor thing, he didn't. No more than I do now. He went away. I stayed by her because I was her mother. I'd go away myself, I would, but people know me, and I haven't a penny. Not a penny. They'd bring me back to her, they would, to care for her. It doesn't matter much now, though, because people don't want me any more than they want her, they don't. Ren shifted his feet uneasily because the woman was crying. Have you room for me here? He asked. Her head crept into the light. Ren said swiftly, I'll give you money each week and I'll bring my own bed and things. He was afraid she would refuse. She merged with the shadows again. If you like, she said, trembling at her good fortune, though why you'd want to... Still, I guess if I had a little something to cook up nice and... good reason for it. I could make someone real cozy here. But why? She rose, ran across the room and pushed her back into the chair. He stood over her tall. I never want you to ask me that, he said, speaking very slowly. Here? She swallowed and nodded. I'll come back tomorrow with the bed and things, he said. He left her there under the lamp, blinking out of the dimness, folded round and about with her misery and her wonder. People talked about it. People said, Ren has moved to the house of Bianca's mother. It must be because... Ah, said some. Ren was always a strange boy. It must be because... Oh, no, cried others appalled. Ren is such a good boy. He wouldn't... Harding was told. He frightened the busy little woman who told him. He said, Ren is very quiet, but he's honest and he does his work. As long as he comes here in the morning and earns his wage, he can do what he wants, where he wants. It's not my business to stop him. He said this so very sharply that the little woman dared not say anything more. Ren was very happy living there. Saying little, he began to learn about Bianca's hands. He watched Bianca being fed. Her hands would not feed her, the lovely aristocrats. Beautiful parasites they were, taking their animal life from the heavy, squat body that carried them and giving nothing in return. They would lie one on each side of her plate, pulsing, while Bianca's mother put food into the disinterested, drooling mouth. They were shy, those hands of Ren's bewitched gaze. Caught out there naked in the light and open of the tabletop, they would creep to the edge and drop out of sight, all but four rosy fingertips clutching the cloth. They never lifted from the surface. When Bianca walked, her hands did not swing free but twisted in the fabric of her dress. And when she approached the table, her hands would run lightly up and leap, landing together, resting silently, watchfully, with that pulsing peculiar to them. They cared for each other. They would not touch Bianca herself, but each hand groomed the other. It was the only labor to which they would bend themselves. 3 evenings after he came, Ren tried to take one of the hands in his. Bianca was alone in the room, and Ren went to her and sat beside her. She didn't move, nor did her hands. They rested on a small table before her, preening themselves. This, then, was when they really began watching him. He felt it right down to the depths of his enchanted heart. The hands kept stroking each other, and yet they knew he was there. They knew of his desire. They stretched themselves before him, archly, languorously, and his blood pounded hot. Before he could stay himself, he reached and tried to grasp them. He was strong, and his move was sudden and clumsy. One of the hands seemed to disappear. So swiftly did it drop to Bianca's lap, but the other... Rand's thick fingers closed on it and held it captive. It writhed, all but tore itself free. It took no power from the arm in which it lived, for Bianca's arms were flabby and weak. Its strength, like its beauty, was intrinsic, and it was only by shifting his grip to the puffy forearm that Rand succeeded in capturing it. So intent was he on touching it, holding it, that he did not see the other hand leap up from the idiot girl's lap, land crouching on the table's edge. It reared back, fingers curled, spider-like, and sprang at him, fastening on his wrist. It clamped down agonizingly, and Rand felt bones give and crackle. With a cry, he released the girl's arm. Her hands fell together and ran all over each other, feeling for any small scratch, any tiny damage that he might have done them in his passion. And as he sat there, clutching his wrist, he saw the hands run to the far side of the little table, hook themselves over the edge, and, contracting, draw her out of her place. She had no volition of her own. Ah, but her hands had. Creeping over the walls, catching obscure and precarious holes in the wainscoting, they dragged the girl from the room. And Rand sat there and sobbed, not so much from the pain in his swelling arm, but in shame for what he had done. They might have been won to him in another, gentler way. His head was bowed, yet suddenly he felt the gaze of those hands. He looked up swiftly enough to see one of them whisk around the doorpost. It had come back then, to see. Rand rose heavily and took himself in his shame away. Yet he was compelled to stop in the doorway, even as had Bianca's hands. He watched covertly and saw them come into the room, dragging the unprotesting idiot girl. They brought her to the long bench where Rand had sat with her. They pushed her onto it, flung themselves to the table, and began rolling and flattening themselves most curiously about. Rand suddenly realized that there was something of his there, and he was comforted a little. They were rejoicing, drinking thirstily, reveling in his tears. Afterwards, for 19 days, the hands made Rand do penance. He knew them as inviolate and unforgiving. They would not show themselves to him, remaining always hidden in Bianca's dress or under the supper table. For those 19 days, Rand's passion and desire grew. More, his love became true love, for only true love knows reverence, and the possession of the hands became his reason for living, his goal in the life which that reason had given him. Ultimately, they forgave him. They kissed him coyly when he wasn't looking, touched him on the wrist, caught and held him for one sweet moment. It was at table. A great power surged through him, and he gazed down at the hands now returned to Bianca's lap. A strong muscle in his jaw twitched, swelled and fell. Happiness like a golden light flooded him. Passion spurred him. Love imprisoned him. Reverence was the gold of the golden light. The room wheeled and whirled about him, and forces unimaginable flickered through him. Battling with himself, yet lax in the glory of it, Rand sat unmoving, beyond the world, enslaved and yet possessor of all. Bianca's hands flushed pink, and if ever hands smiled to each other, then they did. He rose abruptly, flinging his chair from him, feeling the strength of his back and shoulders. Bianca's mother, by now beyond surprise, looked at him and away. There was that in his eyes which she did not like, for to fathom it would disturb her, and she wanted no trouble. Rand strode from the room and outdoors, to be by himself, that he might learn more of this new thing that had possessed him. It was evening. The crooked, bending skyline drank the buoyancy of the sun, dragged it down, sucking greedily. Rand stood on a knoll, his nostrils flaring, feeling the depth of his lungs. He sucked in the crisp air, and it smelled new to him, as though the sunset shades were truly in it. He knotted the muscles of his thighs and stared at his smooth, solid fists. He raised his hands high over his head, and stretching, sent out such a great shout that the sun sank. He watched it, knowing how great and tall he was, how strong he was, knowing the meaning of longing and belonging. And then he lay down on the clean earth, and he wept. When the sky grew cold enough for the moon to follow the sun beyond the hills, and still an hour after that, Rand returned to the house. He struck a light in the room of Bianca's mother, where she slept on a pile of old clothes. Rand sat beside her and let the light wake her. She rolled over to him and moaned, opened her eyes, and shrank from him. "Rand, What do you want? Bianca. I want to marry Bianca. Her breath hissed between her gums. No! It was not a refusal, but astonishment. Rand touched her arm impatiently. Then she laughed. To marry Bianca. It's late, boy. Go back to bed, and in the morning you'll have forgotten this thing, this dream. I've not been to bed, he said patiently, but growing angry. Will you give me Bianca or not? She sat up and rested her chin on her withered knees. You're right to ask me, for I'm her mother. Still and all, Rand, you've been good to us, Bianca and me. You're a good boy, but forgive me, lad, but you're something of a fool. Bianca's a monster. I say it, though I am what I am to her. Do what you like, and never a word will I say. You should have known. I'm sorry you asked me, for you have given me the memory of speaking so to you. I don't understand you, but do what you like, boy. It was to have been a glance, but it became a stare as she saw his face. He put his hands carefully behind his back, and she knew he would have killed her else. I'll marry her then, he whispered. She nodded, terrified. As you like, boy. He blew out the light and left her. Rand worked hard and saved his wages and made one room beautiful for Bianca and himself. He built a soft chair and a table that was like an altar for Bianca's sacred hands. There was a great bed and heavy cloth to hide and soften the walls, and a rug. They were married, though marrying took time. Rand had to go far afield before he could find one who would do what was necessary. The man came far and went again afterwards, so that none knew of it, and Rand and his wife were left alone. The mother spoke for Bianca, and Bianca's hands trembled frighteningly at the touch of the ring, writhed and struggled, and then lay passive, blushing and beautiful. But it was done. Bianca's mother did not protest, for she didn't dare. Rand was happy, and Bianca... Well, nobody cared about Bianca. After they were married, Bianca followed Rand and his two brides into the beautiful room. He washed Bianca and used rich lotions. He washed and combed her hair and brushed it many times until it shone, to make her more fit to be with the hands he had married. He never touched the hands, though he gave them soaps and creams and tools with which they could groom themselves. They were pleased. Once one of them ran up his coat and touched his cheek and made him exultant. He left them and returned to the shop with his heart full of music. He worked harder than ever so that Harding was pleased and let him go home early. He wandered the hours away by the bank of a brook, watching the sun on the face of the chuckling water. A bird came to circle him, flew unafraid through the aura of gladness about him. The delicate tip of a wing brushed his wrist with the touch of the first secret kiss from the hands of Bianca. The singing that filled him was part of the nature of laughing, the running of water, the sound of the wind in the reeds by the edge of the stream. He yearned for the hands, and he knew he could go now and clasp them and own them. Instead, he stretched out on the bank and lay smiling, all lost in the sweetness and poignance of waiting, denying desire. He laughed for pure joy in a world without hatred, held in the stainless palms of Bianca's hands. As it grew dark, he went home. All during that nuptial meal, Bianca's hands twisted about one of his while he ate with the other, and Bianca's mother fed the girl. The fingers twined about each other and about his own, so that three hands seemed to be wrought of one flesh, to become a thing of lovely weight at his arm's end. When it was quite dark, they went to the beautiful room and lay where he and the hands could watch through the window the clean, bright stars swim up out of the forest. The house and the room were dark and silent. Rand was so happy that he hardly dared to breathe. A hand fluttered up over his hair, down his cheek, and crawled into the hollow of his throat. Its pulsing matched the beat of his heart. He opened his own hands wide and clenched his fingers as though to catch and hold this moment. Soon the other hand crept up and joined the first. For perhaps an hour they lay there passive with their coolness against Rand's warm neck. He felt them with his throat, each smooth convolution, each firm, small expanse. He concentrated with his mind and his heart on his throat, on each part of the hands that touched him, feeling with all his being first one touch and then another, though the contact was there unmoving. And he knew it would be soon now. Soon. As if at a command, he turned on his back and dug his head into the pillow. Staring up at the vague dark hangings on the wall, he began to realize what it was for which he had been working and dreaming so long. He put his head back yet farther and smiled, waiting. This would be possession, completion. He breathed deeply twice, and the hands began to move. The thumbs crossed over his throat, and the fingertips settled one by one under his ears. For a long moment they lay there, gathering strength. Together then, in perfect harmony, each cooperating with the other, they became rigid, rock hard. Their touch was still light upon him, still light. No, now they were passing their rigidity to him, turning it to a contraction. They settled to it slowly, their pressure measured and equal. Rand lay silent. He couldn't breathe now, and didn't want to. His great arms were crossed on his chest, his knotted fists under his armpits, his mind knowing a great peace. Soon now. Wave after wave of engulfing glorious pain spread and receded. He saw color impossible without light. He arched his back, up, up. The hands bore down with all their hidden strength, and Rand's body bent like a bow, resting on feet and shoulders, up, up. Something burst within him, his lungs, his heart. No matter. It was complete. There was blood on the hands of Bianca's mother when they found her in the morning in the beautiful room, trying to soothe Rand's neck. They took Bianca away, and they buried Rand. But they hanged Bianca's mother because she tried to make them believe Bianca had done it. Bianca, whose hands were quite dead, drooping like brown leaves from her wrists.
Huh. That, my friends, is what you call tour de force writing. Here's some more. In his liner notes for Circle of Wind, Colin MacDonald says of this piece, "This saxophone quartet is named for the yogic term prana, which refers to the energetic life force that can be controlled by the breath. As players of wind instruments, saxophonists have to create a lot of energy through their breath, and I wanted to evoke and encourage this energetic playing. A passacaglia melody runs throughout the composition, overlaid with short canonic cycles. Melodic and rhythmic activity builds steadily toward a breathless climax at the end." Here now are Colin MacDonald with David Branter, Tony Shepherd, and Julian Nolan playing Prana.
Thank you.
Stuff I like to hear coming out of the speakers when I'm writing myself. To order a copy of Colin McDonald's Circle of Wind, surf to http://crypticmusic.bandcamp.com/album/circle-of-wind. That's crypticmusic.bandcamp.com/album/circle-of-wind. For $10, you can download the whole album in a flash as MP3 at 320K, or if you prefer, in nerd formats like FLAC files or MP3 VBR, the lovely AAC format that Apple's iTunes uses, Ogg Vorbis, or even ALAC files. With the download comes a PDF of the liner notes and album art, or for an extra $5, you can have a physical CD in a physical jewel case with liner notes and art already printed out and put in place, mailed to you, and you can still choose to download the whole album in any of the above formats while you're waiting for your actual artifact to arrive in the post. Now, come on, Mike, you can't ask fairer than that. Colin McDonald's Circle of Wind, available at crypticmusic.bandcamp.com/album/circle-of-wind. And now here is one of my favorite Sturgeon readings. It is an excerpt from a book he worked on all his life and refused to sell for gold while he was alive. Thank all gods he allowed it to be published posthumously. It is called God Body, and I think of it as his attempt to rewrite the New Testament for the new millennium, removing all the gross and sick distortions that crept into the original and putting the sex back into it. Ted said, if you're talking about God and sex doesn't come up, you aren't talking about God. He noted that people having sex are generally the ones most likely to call directly to God, especially if it's going well. Here, by contrast, is an excerpt from Godbody that wouldn't even call for a soft R rating from the most scrupulous censor, but nonetheless possesses great power and beauty.
Passage from the novel Godbody. The speaker is a girl called Britt Svengland. Britt is a hermit. She lives up in a mountainside. She speaks to no one. She cloaks herself in a heavy garment when she goes into town to buy necessaries. Otherwise, she lives off the land, and she has her art. And she says, yes, it has been lonely these years. But why is it when people say the word lonely, that has always to be like a bad thing or sad? You go alone after you have been hurt to get well like a forest animal. Then is getting well a bad thing or sad? No. Mr. Currier said in church one of the times I went there, any person who cannot be by himself, it's because when he is by himself, he thinks he is not in good company. Also, I read a little book once about the top of the soil, just the first 6 inches under the grass, and everything that happens in it. If you have a 10-power microscope, and if you take the time and care, you could spend all day every day for more than a year seeing and understanding all the things that are happening in just 1 square foot of topsoil. There are plants and animals and chemicals growing and changing all the time in a tiny world like that. There is a fungus which makes a noose with a trigger. And when small creatures come into it, bang, the noose closes and catches them, and the fungus eats the animals. There are eggs that hatch and insects that make certain scents to call other insects to love or to die, and much more, so much more, all in 1 square foot of dirt. So how can anyone with eyes to see and a heart to question say that he is bored? There is nothing to do. Summer and winter, I work and read. In the summer, I warm my body under the sun, and in the winter, I watch the fire and think. Whatever I need, I make it or do without. Some things I must buy. Flour and salt and soap and books. Paint. For my work, almost everything I need can be found. That is because of my art secret. My art secret is this. There is only one sense, and it is the sense of touch. All the other ones are just kinds of touch, the same way the scientists say that matter and energy are only different kinds of the same thing. Most of the artists in the world who are, or whoever were painters. That's good, but a painter's work is meant not to be touched. Sometimes you should not, sometimes you must not touch the work. But I have my art secret, and so, when I make a picture of a mountain, I make the sky of a piece of silk, and the mountainside of bark, and bits of stone, and sand, and water, or glass, or bits of plastic that I sometimes find. Oh, yes, I make colors. But I could make a picture of a mountain and a sky all the same color exactly. But because the sky was silk, and the faraway hills were burlap, and the near ones bark and stone, you could see the picture anyway. Also, sometimes I mix honey in my sky color, bitter roots in my sharp rocks, smooth spices like allspice and paprika in my smooth stone, mint and sage in my greens. You can put your hands on my work. You can put your mouth on my work. You can smell it here and there. So then, why is it bad or sad to be alone? I am not sad when in the morning I look up into the sky and taste it, and when I know the feel and smell of the faraway hills. Also, I have my goats and a wild apple tree, and things grow for me in the garden, little green promises that in good time are kept. I will give you tomatoes. I promised you corn. People do not always keep their promises, even when you tend their soil. Sometimes they do, but you never know. Also, when a bee stings or a rock falls and hurts you, or a knife cuts you for being careless, these are not really attacks. These things are defending themselves, or they are giving you the results of causes. There is always a reason. People sometimes attack you without a reason, and you never really know when. So it is better not to be with people. Some boys climbed the hill behind my house and saw me naked, and they threw stones. That is not a reason, you see. The sense of touch is a crystal with many faces. Air explodes away between the hammer and the anvil and disturbs the air around it, which in turn disturbs the air again, and these disturbances walk toward you like footsteps until they touch the membrane of the ear. So it is, too, with the rush of sound through the stiff feathers of a crow and the soft ones of an owl's wing, and each has a different meaning. To see is to touch also, and to be seen is to be touched, and this too has its many meanings. To be seen by a cruel boy with a stone in his hand is not the same touch as being seen by a stag or by a squirrel. If you live as I do, and know how to touch and be touched by eyes, you can feel eyes upon you even when you cannot see them, and you can know what kind of touch it is. I knew there were eyes on me when I went to the garden to gather a handful of chives and a few leaves of tender new lettuce, and all I could tell about the touch was what it was not. It was not the touch of a deer, which, to me on my mountain, is not fearful but merely alert, nor the touch of rabbits, in which you can feel total terror and, in an instant, total forgetfulness, nor the squirrel's contact, which always has laughter in it. What touched me was not the gaze of a carnivore, either. Wildcat and fox browse you with their eyes like shoppers, wondering and judging whether or not they can afford you. And if this touch was that of a man, it was such a man as I had never known. It was such a man as I had never known. Once in my first winter in this country, I saw a bird for the very first time on a cold morning in which there was only white, which was altogether white, and black, which was altogether black. And this bird was all the color in the whole universe of that place and time. This bird was a clear and aching red. I have come to know it well since, but this was my first one. They call it cardinal. My feeling then was more than joy. It was pride, for I thought at the moment I had produced the cardinal, invented it. It was in my mind as I saw it that I had made it be by a necessity born of a world of total white and absolute black. Oh, please laugh at this arrogance of mine. Laugh with me as I laughed at the time, and laugh now to think of it, that I felt I had the power to create a cardinal. Now in a world of many greens and browns, under a sky that must taste like the inside of the skin of a Concord grape and the passing shadow of a macaroon cloud, the man appeared. He stood just off the path between the garden and my house, and as our eyes met, he stepped back a pace, a message that he would not bar me, and he smiled, which was a message that I need not fear him, for he feared neither me nor himself. He was naked, but he wore nakedness like a garment. He wore it better, I think, than I. Light lay on him like a fabric, an air tailored to him. He was umber, amber, ochre, and gold. The modeling of his face had been done with a flat tool and beautifully finished, for it was all planes and rounded joinings, and brows, eyes, and lips all parallel. His hair was red of a kind, his eyes another red, his skin a series of others. And the difference between my seeing this man and my encounter with the cardinal was this. There was in that first blazing glimpse of him no slightest feeling that I could have created him or anything like him. I am artist enough to acknowledge the necessity of a cardinal in the snow. I was not, I am not, capable of such a concept as this man.
That was pretty good, Cross.
Really good.
Did we lose Stills?
What was that?
No, it's not time for that. Yeah, we're going to lay me down, right?
We're going to do the single.
The single. We're going to do it. Actually, we're going to do it for the only two people who've learned it besides us, who are Spider and Jeannie Robinson.
This is the opening track to me and Crosby's last record that came out about 8 months ago.
And it was a single.
Stop him before he talks again.
Sorry. But we did have a single. It was kind of an event. It got on the radio.
He's having an acid flashback. Don't worry about things. It's okay. It's from somewhere in the 60s. A small piece got dislodged and just came on about 10 minutes ago. A song written by our brilliant keyboard player, Mr. James Raymond. It's called Lay Me Down.
Driving out through the windmills, and some of them were still. Sometimes it's hard to catch the wind and bend it to your will. Even though it's hard, just how the story is. The road is long and it takes its time. On that you can depend. Lay me down in the river and wash this place away. Break me down like sand from a stone, maybe I'll be whole again one day. Lay me down, lay me down, maybe I'll be whole again. Lay me down. Somewhere between heaven and hell, a soul knows where it's been. I want to feel my spirit lifted up and catch my breath again. Lay me down in the river and wash this place away. Break me down like sand from a stone, maybe I'll be whole again one day. Lay me down, lay me down, maybe I'll be whole again. Lay me down. Lay me down, lay me down, maybe I'll be whole again one day.
Well, that's about a full lid. Before I let you go, though, I'd like to share some good news that came to me recently. First, some good news for me, hinted out by the music that I just played for you. As I told you back at the beginning of this podcast, my sister Dory books for the Zyterian Theater in New Bedford, Mass. Well, recently, David Crosby heard the title track from McCarthy and Leger's new CD, Tickets to the Moon, which I played in my last podcast, and he liked it a lot and got in touch with Dory. And to make a long story short, things went so well that this May 24th, the Z will be hosting Crosby and Nash. That will be 1 week before the anniversary of my Jeannie's departure. So I plan to fly out to New Bedford for the gig, and then hang around for a week and mark that anniversary surrounded by Jeannie's mother and all her sisters and my own daughter and her family. That should be some solace, I hope. Next comes some very good news for everybody, but particularly for fans of Stardance, patient as you've all been. My second bit of good news is that Jeannie's partner and co-producer James Spasto of Memphis has just finished the screenplay for her Stardance movie in collaboration with the great David Gerald of Martian Child and Trouble with Tribbles fame. You've probably seen the YouTube footage of Jeannie and her dancer Kate McDonough in Zero-G that James himself shot aboard Peter Diamandis' NASA training jet G-Force 1 high above Las Vegas. Jeannie was able to see a fairly substantial draft of the screenplay before she had to leave the party and pronounced herself very pleased with what she saw. I have now had the opportunity to read the completed script, and I am hugely happy to tell you that I am just as pleased as Jeannie was. In fact, the word I'd use is thrilled. My hat's off to Jim and David. They have written a hit. There are at least 3-star roles that actors will be killing for, and a guaranteed Best Choreography Oscar, and consistent plain good old writing. The story differs significantly from the novella Jeannie and I wrote back in 1976, and owes to its improvement, making it work better in cinematic terms for a mainstream modern audience. So, if you know somebody with a few megabucks to invest and a burning desire to become artistically immortal, to literally help create the first brand new art form of the next millennium while telling one of the great love stories of all time, tell them to email James Spasto at js@spasto.com. Zero-G choreographers and or dancers are also welcome to get in touch, but the primary need at the present is for someone with vision and a big checkbook. I understand that as I speak, some seriously heavy industry people are being pitched, and when and if there's anything to report, you will hear it here second. To hear it first, for the most up-to-the-minute breaking news, visit www.stardancemovie.com. I am really excited. Jeannie put a lot of her heart and soul into this movie, even in the final months of her life. The screenplay credit on the title page reads, "By David Gerald and James Spasto with Jeannie Robinson." She would be so gassed to see this project finally take this great step forward. My last bit of good news is for me and for you and for my patient creditors. Finally, after much pain and much patience, I have managed to start up the novel that's been up on blocks since Jeannie was diagnosed with terminal cancer, Orphan Stars. The rusty, disused engine has finally coughed, wheezed, and turned over. With a whole lot of luck and a great deal of coffee, I may be able to actually start it in forward motion and only another 100 years of pain or so. Something to look forward to. A lot of you out there have given me a tremendous amount of support lately. kind and generous and wonderful warm support, and I know I owe you all a good book in return. I'm back at work on it, at least, and will give it my best shot as always. All right, to play us out, here's one more track from McCarthy and Leger's Tickets to the Moon, and to compensate for my natural bias toward tracks with lead vocals by Dory, here's one that features her peer and partner Butch McCarthy with If Wendy Calls.
She needs a cigarette and a calling card. Got no 3 months of rehab, it's just too damn hard. She needs you badly, she wants you madly, and she loves you so. But if Wendy calls, if Wendy calls, just say no. She's on the phone again with her sister-in-law. The things that she's heard and the things she saw, she'll do anything, she'll even sing for another glass of cheap Merlot. Wendy calls, Wendy calls, just say no. Checking her bag, just making sure, but she can't remember what she's looking for. A match for the cover, a faded number, a lover from long ago. But if Wendy calls, if Wendy calls, just say no.
That's Spider on the Web number 88. Come back next time when I plan to play you some specimen short stories from Cory Doctorow's precedent-setting audio short story collection with celebrity readers, with a little help. Until then, thank you kindly for your support and for letting me borrow an hour of your attention. I hope I've returned it in satisfactory condition.